From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been checking in on states. Today, tiny Rhode Island with about a million residents and the highest per capita rate for testing for the coronavirus, three times as many tests as the country on average. Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo joins us now. Welcome back, Governor.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, you've got densely packed cities in Rhode Island, proud immigrant communities, fishing towns, and sprawling estates in places like Newport. Taylor Swift lives there, for Pete's sake. So who gets tested? How are you reaching those packed communities that may not have cars or speak English?
Yeah, it's a great question. As you point out, Rhode Island has some unique vulnerabilities. We're the most densely populated state in the country, and we are nestled between two major hotspots in New York City and Boston. So I've tried to be very aggressive and creative as it relates to testing. One of the things that we are doing that seems to be working is walk-through sites. They might be in the parking lot of a church, the parking lot of a community health center, or the parking lot of a school, and people can walk there.
Can anyone come?
Yes, but you have to have an appointment.
Right.
So you call, you say, I'm sick, I'd like to be tested, you get an appointment, and then you show up for your appointment.
And do you have to have, so you have to be sick, do you have to have symptoms?
Yes. At this point, you have to have symptoms. We have a special separate program for testing of people in nursing homes, our veterans home. And in those places, we are testing everybody.
When we spoke with you and early on, you said, you know, you at first didn't want to do shelter in place. And then you were Katie bar the door. Shelter in place, but also police there were questioning owners of cars without a state license plates from New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, thinking there might be people who might be fleeing to their summer homes and bringing the virus with them. I mean, you really brought down the hammer. You told people who were gathering on the beaches, knock it off. How tough do you think a governor has to be in these times?
Very tough. You know, I feel good about all the decisions we made. You know, if anything, I think as governors look back, they probably wish maybe we reacted a bit sooner. But at the time, obviously, it seemed like such dramatic moves. Fortunately, because we were aggressive, we're now in a place where hospitalizations have leveled off. ICU hospitalizations have leveled off. And if that stays that way for the next couple of weeks, I would like to reopen the economy in a very phased, incremental way. It's like a dial or the dimmer switch on a light switch. Every place around the world where they have gotten the virus under control, opened the economy, and then had to clamp down again, the outbreak has been caused by some communal living circumstance. So we really have to keep our eye on that as we're putting the lights back on with the dimmer switch.
Well, and so you're getting kudos for the testing. Just your thoughts on the White House saying the federal government should be a supplier of last resort. Now, many of your testing is done, as we said, in partnership with CVS. You've got some federal funds, private sector donations. But because CVS is so prominent in your state, do you think that's what's making the difference? In other words, how much more would you have needed the federal government involvement if you didn't have that?
It's certainly been a help. I would say that while I may or may not agree with the federal government's approach on being the provider of last resort, it is what it is. So I have done a lot of public-private partnering. You know, in an ideal world, you'd like to think the federal government would have a robust nationwide public health response. In the absence of that, the governor has to get it done. And so I've reached out to a lot of companies, and they've all been excellent. In every instance, have stepped up to do these public-private partnerships.
Yeah. Well, you've had protesters, you know, they call themselves Reopen Rhode Island. You had one of those images of protesters holding Trump signs and Bibles and calling you a tyrant, squaring off with nurses in scrubs. But they also say they're out of work. They are, some of them, desperate. What would you say to them?
Yeah. You know, I hear it. I hear what you're saying, and I, to them, I mean, and it, terrible to be out of work. We're working our tail off to get unemployment insurance checks out as fast as possible, and I hope they're able to apply and get that. In the meantime, listen, I've spent 6 years as governor doing nothing but getting Rhode Islanders back to work. The last thing I want to do is put people out of work. But the truth is, it was necessary. The projections on the number of deaths we would have seen, the total overwhelming of our healthcare system. So I had to take action. Not that I wanted to. I'm faced with all bad options, and I'm going to get you back to work as soon as we can, but I have to take into account the health and safety of all the people of Rhode Island.
That's Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo. Governor Raimondo, thank you so much, and best of luck to you.
Thank you, Robin. Take care of yourself.
By the way, the governor also asked artist Shepard Fairey, who created an iconic Obama poster and studied at the Rhode Island School of Design, to design a poster of the state's motto, which is hope. He did. It is beautiful. We'll post it at herenow.org.
Let's get some reaction now to President Trump's executive order yesterday, classifying meat processing plants as critical infrastructure. The president pledged to keep plants open under the proper safety guidelines, but at least 20 meat workers have died from the virus. David Seligman is director of Towards Justice, a nonprofit law firm involved in a lawsuit against Smithfield Foods in Missouri over the coronavirus, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
David, what's your reaction to this order?
Well, I think that it's atrocious and highly concerning. First, let me say that although the president has said that he's seeking to ensure that these meatpacking plants stay open and comply with federal health and safety guidelines, the CDC came out with guidelines over this weekend, and it's not clear that most meatpacking plants are following those. Workers are at risk, and the broader community is at risk. This seems like an effort not to protect workers and not to protect the food supply, but rather to protect the CEOs and executives and shareholders who profit off of big corporations involved in the food supply chain.
And you mentioned those CDC guidelines along with the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Some of those guidelines, which are voluntary, by the way, physical distancing barriers, reducing carpools by workers, staggering breaks, those types of things. You know, a number of meat plants have closed in the last couple of months. We were just talking with an expert yesterday about the 25% reduction in the country's pork slaughter capacity. Tyson Meats has already been warning of potential shortages. What is your opinion about these closures? Is there a way to avoid closures while still ensuring the safety of workers?
There is. You know, I think the way to ensure that closures don't happen and preserve the nation's food supply is to follow workplace safety guidelines. That's not been happening. As a consequence, people have gotten sick. People have died. Workers have died. Their family members have died. Broader communities have been harmed by these outbreaks. There are lots of ways for us to continue producing meat and protect workplace safety. That means these companies have to make some sacrifices. But right now, those sacrifices don't seem to be happening. And instead, they're externalizing all of the costs of this pandemic onto their workers, many of whom are marginalized immigrants, and to the broader communities in which these plants sit.
Let's talk a little bit about workers' rights. What if a worker's plant is open, but they don't feel safe going there? Maybe they're older or they have a pre-existing condition. What are their rights? Can they take any sick time?
They're in many places, sick leave could be available. And it seems like some plants may be suggesting that it is available. But as a matter of law, I think that in many cases, workers aren't going to be protected. We know that the sick leave provisions of the Families First Coronavirus Relief Act, for example, carve out big businesses of over 500 employees. Many meatpacking companies will fall within that exemption. So many workers will not have access to sick leave. And this is happening against the backdrop of an industry that has for decades taken advantage of workers and given them the impression that they'll be punished for taking leave at all. That creates an incredibly dangerous situation, not only for the workers who continue going to the plant even when they're sick, but also for their families and for their communities.
Have you been in touch with any of these workers at the plants? And what are they telling you?
We're hearing that workers are scared. Workers continue to feel like they have to show up to work, even if they may be experiencing symptoms. You know, I think that it's a critical point to understand how much fear many of these workers feel to report problems or to report that they're sick or to take sick leave because of the tremendous and horrible repercussions that they may experience, whether, you know, at the hands of their employer or broader concerns with immigration enforcement. But I think another key aspect of the, you know, relationship between these issues and, you know, the immigration status of workers is that because undocumented workers often won't have access to unemployment insurance and don't have access to unemployment insurance, you know, those workers, as opposed to others who may have benefited from expanded unemployment insurance during the pandemic, those workers are going to continue to feel pressures to come into work and even to take on new jobs. For example, if they're not working in meatpacking, to even take on new jobs that put them at terrible risk, but jobs that, are available and jobs that these companies, you know, feel like they can continue recruiting people to fill because of the president's order, notwithstanding that they're going to continue to put those people at risk and continue to put the broader communities in which their plants sit at risk.
That's David Seligman. He is director of Towards Justice, a nonprofit law firm. David, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tanya.
And as we mentioned, Towards Justice is suing Smithfield Foods to force the company to do more to protect workers from the virus. There will be a hearing in the case tomorrow, and we have reached out to Smithfield Foods for comment.
When COVID-19 started spreading rapidly, hospitals throughout the country began canceling elective surgeries, not just cosmetic procedures, but brain surgeries and organ transplants. Leslie McClurg from member station KQED in San Francisco talks to patients about what it's like to be critically ill from something other than coronavirus right now.
A rare cancer attacked Sassy Outwater Wright when she was a baby. She lost her sight to the disease, which kept her in her doctor's office a lot.
We've kind of been playing whack-a-mole with tumors for the past 12 years. They get one, the other one starts growing, the other one needs attention, they get that one.
There's another one in her head right now. The 37-year-old redhead was scheduled to have it removed until her doctors determined it wasn't a good idea to open her skull during a pandemic.
The infection risk would be way too high.
The procedure is on pause, but she knows her tumor isn't. She lies awake at night, weighing the risks.
The threat to my life from a tumor that's sitting in my head versus the threat from a virus that's loose in a hospital. And nobody can weigh those odds.
Sassy is one of many critically ill patients sidelined but not sickened by COVID-19. So is Rosemary Pathy McKenney. She started to experience strange health symptoms around New Year's.
Head pressure, numbness, tingling on the right side of my face.
Then, a CAT scan in February revealed two brain tumors. Suddenly, the second grade school teacher in San Jose was fighting a grave illness at the same time COVID-19 was spreading in her city.
Never imagine this. Never.
The first available slot for brain surgery was a month later in mid-March. Rosemary counted down the days to her operation.
It's actually been quite scary because I can't get the COVID right now. I'm compromised medically, right, with what's going on with me, and it worries me.
The day before her surgery, Rosemary drove to San Francisco for a preoperative MRI. A radiologist peered inside her skull to determine where to cut. Her head was shaved, future incisions were marked in blue.
And came out of the MRI and was told that it was canceled.
We shut down. We shut down the OR, almost lock, stock, and barrel.
Dr. Philip Theodosopoulos is Rosemary's neurosurgeon at the University of California, San Francisco.
And everybody calls me Dr. Theo.
He says nearly 2,000 procedures were canceled, anything that wasn't an emergency, to prepare for a surge of COVID patients.
These include cancer, include aneurysms. This is not just brain surgery. This is all surgery.
People like Rosemary were told to go home and wait.
Can she wait more than a month? I would say, well, not without deficit, probably not.
And now, that month has passed. During that time, her vision worsened, and doctors in the Bay Area are still waiting for the surge of COVID to hit.
We are pretty much at a standstill, truly.
There are more than 200 empty hospital beds at UCSF, which raises an ethical dilemma for Dr. Theo.
There is a lot of diagnoses that we don't really know how long we can wait.
That's why UCSF started to reschedule a few surgeries for the most serious cases. Rosemary was one of them.
Hello?
It's your husband. How are you doing?
Oh, boy. I'm very nauseated.
Rosemary's husband, Rick, called because visitors are no longer allowed inside. Her surgery went well. One down, thousands to go. It will take about 6 months to catch up on all the procedures that were put on hold. That's assuming coronavirus doesn't hit again. For Here and Now, I'm Leslie McClurg in San Francisco.
Because of COVID-19's effect on the economy, a lot of people are thinking back to the Great Depression, and in particular, President Roosevelt's job creation programs. Thousands of artists were put to work in the 1930s under the Works Progress Administration Federal Art Project. But did you know that that project was inspired in part by post-revolutionary thinking in Mexico, and that it led to the development of community art centers throughout the country? Joining us now is Jody Patterson, who wrote about this recently for Art News. She's a professor of art history at Ohio State University. And Professor Patterson, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Well, there's a lot of history here, but first I'm thinking about the climate of when the WPA came to be versus now. This idea of spurring job growth through art has not been an option for President Trump yet. What's the difference between then and now?
Well, I would say there are quite a few differences. So in both instances, back in the 30s and then again now, the cultural sector had very much shut down due to, you know, an economic crisis. In this particular instance, in the moment that we're in now, Congress can't really seem to agree on much of anything. And the current president has been no great ally of the arts. So he's consistently called, for example, for the elimination of the NEH and the NEA. And he also has supporters who do not think that cultural matters are within the purview of the federal government. And so even though there has recently been an emergency aid bill, Roosevelt's program was pushed through by a popular president whose party controlled both houses of Congress. And it came at a time when I think a lot more people in government were able to see maybe the morale boosting benefits of creating more space for culture as part of an everyday experience.
What's notable to you looking back on that time in history when Roosevelt structured these programs, particularly the Works Progress Administration?
Even before President Roosevelt was coming to office, there was a cultural movement that was gaining great profile and visibility in Mexico. So just there, south of the border, providing a model for public art. And that was, of course, post-revolutionary Mexico. So after the military stages of the revolution, the Mexican government brought in artists, hired them as wage laborers to visualize a shared history in a way that was accessible even to the hundreds of thousands of Mexicans who at this point were still illiterate. So this kind of collective expression was very much the model that was taken on by the Federal Art Project and transposed into the American context.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking because of the WPA, many Americans back then experienced their first original artworks, either in the form of concerts or public art, particularly murals, some of them are still around today. Several hundred thousand original works were created by professional artists. Can you give us some examples and what the impact of all of that was?
One particular set of murals that is still extant and still visible in the Schomburg Research Center, created by the African-American artist Aaron Douglas, who was very much a part of the earlier Harlem Renaissance and became an instructor within the federal projects. That mural cycle, which gives a sweeping history of African-American life and culture within the United States, is there as this kind of visual history, much like we would have had stained glass windows or frescoes in churches during earlier periods. Here is a history that, regardless of your level of education or literacy, your familiarity with fine art, is there in bold color and form. So the impact, I think, ideally, and in certainly what the intention was, to provide access to art through, you know, public mural painting was an exemplary means of doing that, but the community art centers that had traveling exhibitions, art instruction. So really, you know, making art part of an everyday experience.
Yeah. You know, we're thinking and talking about all of this in the context of right now and today in this pandemic, but was the WPA always viewed as successful or really the best government policy?
Well, no, absolutely not. There were absolutely adversaries that saw this as very wasteful and boondoggling was the word that was consistently used towards some of these initiatives. And many people, as is still the case today, did not think it was the business, certainly of the federal government, to be getting involved in cultural matters.
Hmm. If you had President Trump's ear right now about enacting this type of program, during this time that we're dealing with, what would you say?
This could be an opportunity to think about what a sustainable future for the arts might look like. So the cultural sector, I think, has long suffered a kind of precariousness and vulnerability that other industries, if you will, don't. And funding for culture in this country, at any rate, has fairly consistently been contingent upon a wealthy elite or private philanthropy. And we might see now that this isn't such a reliable infrastructure with the market crash and whatnot. So although the New Deal is not a template to replicate and contemporary circumstances are different, there are insights to learn from and I think legacies to build on that might make culture something that's more accessible and something that's more part of what we think of it as to be living the American dream or the American way of life rather than something that's cast off into this ivory tower and left so vulnerable.
Yeah, I mean, in thinking back to the time of Roosevelt, he also used this as a way to communicate values of democracy, American values.
Absolutely. Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini were engaging art and artists in public works to raise their profile and consolidate their power. So democracy, like communism and fascism, also instrumentalized art as a means of asserting and legitimizing its power amongst its citizens. Roosevelt, like other leaders, needed to build popular support, consensus for government action, and needed to show how democracy offered this more abundant life with culture being part of that in relation to competing political systems that were emerging and gaining power at the time.
Professor Jody Patterson at Ohio State University and author of the book Modernism for the Masses, Painters, Politics, and Public Murals in 1930s New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
While airline travel has gone down significantly, we've also been seeing some images online of crowded flights, and many airlines are now trying to find ways to minimize the risk of catching COVID-19. Joining us now about this and other airline stories we've been following today is Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. And Seth, one of the photos we saw was of a packed flight where only some of the passengers were wearing masks. This week, JetBlue said it will require all passengers to wear face coverings. How will this work?
Well, this is beginning March 4th, so they're giving people several days here, and you're going to have to bring your own face covering.
May 4th,
now, it
yeah.
can be a scarf or something homemade, certainly not an N95 mask nor anything close to that. But yeah, everybody's going to have to wear one when they get on a JetBlue flight, no exceptions.
Okay, yeah, and that's May 4th, right? Yeah, I was reading
exactly.
about airports. Yeah, airports in Canada requiring all visitors to wear face masks, and the airports or airlines will not be providing those masks. Has there been any talk of rules like this being implemented at U.S. airports?
Not close to anything like that, and I think that's why you've seen JetBlue go ahead and do what it has done. You know, in this case, consumer pressure, right? Not just regulatory yeah. pressure. So much in the U.S. has been really decentralized, right? A lack of federal guidelines on a lot of things, including this. So, right, Canada said, very simple, if you're in an airport or you're getting on an airplane, you need to have a mask. They sort of took that decision away from the airlines. I think JetBlue in this case probably just kind of saw the future and said, hey, we might as well get the PR benefit of this. Wouldn't be at all surprised to see other airlines follow suit.
Yeah. And speaking of other airlines, United, Delta, and American already require some employees to wear face masks. You're expecting, as you said, they may follow suit soon. I want to also ask you about something else. Airbus's chief executive said this week that the airlines may not recover and that this is the gravest crisis that the aerospace industry has ever known. Here in the U.S., the airline industry received a $50 billion lifeline from the federal government. It's a big question, but where does their future lie?
Yeah, and like so much of this, the biggest question of all has nothing to do with the airline industry or with other specific industries, but just what the course of the pandemic itself is going to be, right, Tanya? These airlines in the U.S., though, did go into this crisis in better shape than they went into past crises. The problem is that this crisis, as you said, is just so much worse than the others. Look, they're okay here for the next several months because they got all that money to pay the salaries of their employees. Let's see what happens come October 1st. That's when the aid runs out, at least as it exists right now. Now, some people are already saying they're going to need more. But Delta CEO Ed Bastian, quoted by Politico the other day, saying he's not so sure they're going to get any more. And reading between the lines, you wonder if that's just a prediction or if there's any part of wishful thinking there. Delta is one of the airlines that went into this in better shape than others. Southwest would be another. And if there's a war of attrition, look, no airline can last forever without customers. No business can last forever without customers. But there are airlines that would last longer, Tanya, than others.
So much to watch here. That's Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Seth, as always, thank you.
Likewise, Tanya, thank you.
The economic freeze caused by the current lockdown is having a huge impact on global consumption of fossil fuel. As you might imagine, it's way down. So is that good news for climate change? Reporter Daniel Grossman talked to a number of scientists to find out.
Oil, coal, and gas use has dropped since the pandemic began. Global consumption of oil, the biggest loser, could be down 30% this month. In the U.S., gasoline use has been cut in half. Less fuel use means that we're pumping less carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Our analysis suggests we're going to see the largest ever reduction in carbon emissions in 1 year.
Simon Evans, deputy editor of Carbon Brief, a climate publication in London, predicts an emissions decline of 2 billion tons, or 5.5%.
That would be, you know, roughly twice as large as the previously largest ever around the end of the Second World War. So it's really significant.
You might think that such a decline would cause a big drop in CO2 accumulating in the atmosphere. But Ralph Keeling, a professor at the Scripps Institution near San Diego, who oversees CO2 measurements at Hawaii's Mauna Loa Atmospheric Observatory, says he hasn't noticed it yet.
At this point, we don't think there's any detectable deviation from what we might expect.
Researchers report that near cities, air pollution such as unhealthy particulate matter has plummeted. But when it comes to carbon dioxide and climate change, what matters is not local levels, but how much the entire globe's atmosphere is changing. And so far, the slowdown of CO2 accumulating in the atmosphere is obscured by natural fluctuations, like volcanoes that pump out CO2, but not at a constant rate. Oceans and forests also vary in the amount of CO2 that they remove from the air. These and other factors vary the atmospheric concentration day by day and month by month. Imagine the atmosphere is a bathtub, Keeling says, and our smokestacks and tailpipes are the tap.
If you turn down the tap, you can see immediately the water flowing into the tub is slowed. But it may take you a little while to figure out that the level in the tub is actually filling more slowly.
Eventually, the pandemic slowdown may show up as a dip in the data, says Keeling. But Simon Evans says the long-term impact will probably be insignificant anyway. After the pandemic is over, fossil fuel use will come roaring back.
People's cars are parked on the driveway. Planes are not flying anywhere. Offices are closed. But the car is still the same car. You know, the plane is still the same plane. The factory, once it reopens, will have exactly the same emissions.
People are getting a real education these days about things you don't normally hear about on the news.
Climate researcher Chris Karnauskas at the University of Colorado says while nobody would ever wish a pandemic on the world, the event could be a teachable moment.
Like exponential curves and models and concepts like earlier action means the guaranteed impacts can be less severe. Guess what? That sounds an awful lot like climate scientists have been saying for decades.
For Here and Now, I'm Daniel Grossman.
Well, the grounding of most commercial aviation and restrictions on all international travel is also wreaking havoc in an unexpected area. Meteorology. And with hurricane season around the corner, a lack of accurate information could have serious consequences, not just here, but around the world, at a time when people are already struggling. Allison Chinchar is a meteorologist with CNN. She's been reporting on the relationship between aviation and weather forecasting and joins us by Skype. So, Allison, what do commercial flights have to do with meteorology?
Right. So you wouldn't necessarily think of something like, you flying to Europe or a friend flying to Mexico really having much to do with it. But it's actually very important, especially when it comes to forecasting. Now, there are a lot of places that we get observations from. Yes, obviously, we get them from airlines, but also cruise ships, satellites, buoys, weather balloons, ground stations, and even radars. The problem is those can't be everywhere. So where planes and especially cruise ships are down, those provide us weather observations in places we don't normally have them, specifically over the water. Think about it. Not many people live in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean or in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. So having observations from those planes and from those cruise ships provides us vital information that we really wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah, it's so interesting because when you're flying or on a ship, you're not thinking, oh, we are collecting data. But you say it's the equivalent of thousands of weather balloons.
It is. It's a very significant number. Now, the key thing here where this makes a difference is weather modeling. I'm sure when you hear all of meteorologists talk about hurricane season, for example, you'll often hear meteorologists compare models. You'll say the American model wants the storm to go this way. The European model wants the storm to go this way instead. It's those models that are really going to take the biggest hit from not having this information from the planes. The European model, which is a very respected model, specifically wrote an entire report up about this, the lack of aircraft data. And they explained that the short-range wind and temperature forecasts are going to decrease by 15%. Hear that. They are going to have 15% significant degradation of all of those forecast ranges. And that goes out 7 days. So they're not just saying it's a short term, you know, say the next 24 hours or a 48 hour forecast. You're talking a 7 day forecast. So that's pretty significant.
Yeah. And we're talking about information like air pressure, temperature, wind speed. You're talking about millions of observations, something like 250 million from all of these flights and now cruise ships. We just saw terrible weather rip through the south, you know, huge windstorms in the northeast. What do you think the impact's going to be?
Right. So now over land, it's not going to be as significant of an impact because you do still have local weather service offices. They will issue weather balloons. And they have said that in order to make up for the lack, they will increase their output of weather balloons. But again, that only really helps over land. So the severe storms you spoke about, that really probably didn't take too much of a hit from the lack of data. Where we're most concerned is hurricane season. And unfortunately, we are heading into hurricane season with a big disadvantage for two reasons. Number one, forecasters have said that this coming hurricane season is actually going to be above normal. Knowing that, you also have, where do hurricanes live? Over water. And again, that's the area we spoke about that we're really going to notice the biggest lack of that information and data. When you think about a hurricane, you see it on satellites. They look, you know, beautiful, mesmerizing when you look down from the satellite. And a satellite can tell you where they're located and perhaps their size. But what it can't tell you is what's inside that storm. Is it a category one? Is it a category five? Those are the things that the satellites can't give you. But that weather data from the airplanes, from some of the cruise ship, as they're taking real life column of air observations, that's where we're really going to see the biggest disadvantage heading into hurricane season.
Oh, well, and it's just terrible, as we said, after the tornadoes. So terribly unfair. Tornadoes wrecking homes at a time when people can't go bunk with relatives because of social distancing. We might see the same thing with hurricane season coming up and not get as much warning.
And yes, one other aspect to mention about the shelters. You know, for example, Alexander City, which is just outside of Montgomery, Alabama, announced they would not be opening their shelters due to shelter-in-place procedures. So a lot of people who would normally go to those shelters, or even people who are first timers and got scared of what might happen and decided they wanted to take shelter, they had to find alternative places to go. And even some of the shelters that were in place, they warned people that they may reach max capacity sooner because they have to keep those people at least 6 feet apart. And that's going to be a concern, too, going into hurricane season, because we may have to go through those same protocols yet again in May, June, July, and even through the rest of hurricane season as well.
Tough, tough. That's CNN meteorologist Allison Chinchar on how COVID-19 is playing an indirect role in weather forecasting. Allison, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Vice President Mike Pence opted not to wear a mask during a visit to the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota yesterday, ignoring the clinic's policy. In images circulating on social media, Pence's bare face stands out in a crowd of masked healthcare workers and patients. But defying mask orders is nothing new. In San Francisco, during the flu pandemic of 1918, what people often refer to as the Spanish flu, there was even something called the Anti-Mask League, protesters who hated wearing those gauzy masks and may have contributed to a second wave of deaths. For more, let's bring in Dr. J. Alex Navarro. He's a historian and assistant director for the Center for Medical History at the University of Michigan. Dr. Navarro, welcome.
Hi.
So the Spanish flu, which was not actually a flu from Spain, was actually much deadlier than what we're seeing right now today. Take us back to that time. Were people doing things like social distancing like we are doing today?
They were. And the orders that they implemented back in 1918 in the fall wave were not as sweeping as the ones we're seeing today. These were not closures of all non-essential businesses. They were typically things like closing schools, closing churches, closing theaters and movie houses and places of public gathering and places of public amusement, as well as sometimes in outdoor, but usually indoor gathering bans as well.
Were people pretty compliant?
It's hard to measure compliance, especially from a distance of 100 years, when all we have really to go by are newspaper reports. It seems that in most places, people were compliant. Theater owners in a lot of cities did complain. But in certain places, San Francisco is notable, there were people who balked at some of these social distancing orders or these non-pharmaceutical interventions. And in San Francisco, in particular, it was the wearing of masks that was made mandatory. There were two mandatory mask orders in San Francisco. There was one that came in late October on the heels of some of the other social distancing measures. They lifted all the orders. The influenza came back, and they had another spike of cases. And the city decided to implement solely a masking order in January of 1919. And that was the one that people really detested.
Oh, really? Yeah, we understand that there were a lot of business owners who were worried about the impact to Christmas shopping, culinary workers, unions who wanted restaurants to reopen, clergymen who wanted their parishioners back together. This actually gets to this group called the Anti-Mask League. Tell us a little bit more about them and really this mood that they captured.
Yeah, so in the end of October, in the first closure orders and the mandatory mask order, then there was a lot of grumbling. There seemed to be fairly widespread compliance with the masking order. It was sort of tied by officials and by the Red Cross. They tried to tie it to a sense of patriotism. And of course, this is wartime. So they tried to get people to comply that way. And most people did, although there were some arrests that were made and people were fined for not wearing their masks. In January, people really seemed to dislike wearing the masks. They didn't want to have to go through another set of any of these orders. And these masks, although probably not as uncomfortable as, say, an N95 today, they were made out of surgical gauze, they were still quite uncomfortable for people. And there was a sense from a lot of people that they were interfering with their civil liberties. And there were there was grumblings about lawsuits being brought up. A group of people, including some prominent physicians, created this anti-mask league where they had at least one meeting where over 2,000 people met in a packed auditorium. None of them were wearing masks, of course, and, you know, completely violating what we would consider social distancing today to protest these orders.
What's really interesting, as you pointed out, is that even though Our country is very different than it was back then during World War I. There are quite a few parallels, especially in the context of wearing masks. Up until a few weeks ago, medical professionals were even telling us that masks weren't really useful, and now they're a mandate to enter many public spaces in many areas of the country. How do you interpret this?
You know, it's interesting that there are lots of parallels with 1918. There were physicians in 1918 who recommended the use of masks. There was a famous one, Woods Hutchinson, who walked around or drove around California in particular, and he was the one who pushed masks in San Francisco and Oakland as well as Los Angeles. But there were also plenty of people who thought that they were not effective. There were plenty of physicians who realized that these gauze masks were too porous to really trap any germs, and they would not be effective, and they were just likely to anger people. And I think we see that today as well, although masks are certainly better, at least the medical-grade masks. You know, I do find it interesting there are recommendations to use various face coverings, you know, made out of a bandana or a T-shirt. Now, I'm not an expert in face masks. I think the key takeaway from San Francisco is that if you're going to use face masks, you have to use them in conjunction with other social distancing measures and other these non-pharmaceutical interventions. And I think San Francisco's real issue was that initially they acted late. They did not keep these social distancing measures on for long enough. They didn't issue a second set of them when they needed to. But most importantly, they decided they were going to rely much more heavily on masks than on some of the other orders that would have been more effective.
Mm. So much that history can teach us about the ways that we can actually improve measures during something like a pandemic today. That's Dr. J. Alex Navarro. He's Assistant Director of the Center for Medical History at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.